I'm very happy to welcome now Michael Hamilton Morgan. He is author of the book Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists, which we talked about when it came out. What was that? Three years ago. Mm-hmm. And he is author of the new book, Arabia, In Search of the Golden Ages, which actually accompanies the IMAX film, which we'll also be talking about. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be back.
It's good to have you back. Now, Arabia in Search of the Golden Ages is a very richly illustrated book. Are the illustrations, is the photography in here from the IMAX film?
At least 50% of the photos are outtakes from the film. And then some was also original photography, and then we also have some stock photos in there too.
So what was your role in the making of this film?
I was an advisor to the script. I was a content advisor. Greg McGillivray, who I consider to be the, you know, godfather of American IMAX filmmaking, came to me. He heard me speaking about Lost History 3 years ago, and he said he was working on a project in the Arab world, and would I join up with him? And I hesitated initially because I don't consider myself an expert on Saudi Arabia. I've never lived there. I've been there many times, but I decided to go ahead with it because I felt like it fit in with my own personal mission of trying to build bridges to that part of the world.
And so here you are with this film, which is, I mean, with this book, which is, you could call it a sort of coffee table sized book with these gorgeous, big, interesting photographs. So how did you decide to actually put this together? Was it to accompany the film?
Right. Well, initially we were going to have me follow the film crew and in part do a narrative of the making of the film. But the film was so difficult to make. It was the hardest film that Greg has ever made. And Greg did Everest at 29,000 feet with people freezing to death and falling off cliffs. He said
this
Arabia was three times harder.
Why?
It was culturally and politically harder. Saudi is not a film center. There is no film culture there. You can't go to a movie in Saudi Arabia. You can watch a DVD at home, but there are no public theaters because the mutawin, the religious police, are afraid that men and women are going to do bad things in the dark. So they don't have theaters. So there was no culture to even work with there. There's no infrastructure. Everything had to be approved by the king. Went all the way up to the king and would sit on his desk for 3 months. The king's very busy.
Yeah.
He's got to run the country. So this was a tiny little thing on his radar screen, and it was just... So what I did was...
How did they accomplish all that?
It's a long story, but what we decided to do was I would do my own individual narrative based on my travels, and then when possible, intersect with the film. But we kind of went our separate ways because they sat there at one point 4 months waiting for permission to go to Mecca. They waited 4 months.
Yeah.
And it's just really expensive and a royal
pain. Yeah, to have a film crew sitting in an expensive country.
Yeah.
So you decided to go your own way. So yeah. Tell us about your process.
Well, I have my own contacts there. And, for example, the king invited me to his – he has a ranch outside Riyadh. And he has an annual festival of Saudiness. It's called Jenadriya. And it's really, I don't know how to describe it, but it's when Saudis get together and celebrate being Saudis. And it's very insular and closed. I was invited to that. I was the only American there. There were, I think, about 1 million people come. The only other American I encountered was the king's helicopter pilot, a former Air Force guy. Everybody else was from the Middle East, from Muslim countries. And so... I mean, for this festival, I was sitting as close as to the king as we are to the fellow at the next table. And so I got to watch this very powerful and enigmatic man up close. I met him briefly, chatted through interpreters, but...
Did you tell him your friends needed permits?
No. I didn't want to get in trouble.
Right.
But, and we were in that, it was a bulletproof observation area. That you've seen it before when Obama went to Saudi, he was in that same section on the ranch and George Bush before him. And we watched this festival going on. It was like a Las Vegas Cirque du Soleil quality celebration of Saudi history. The glass is about 3 inches thick. And what it turned into, it really was a pep rally for the king. I've never seen anything like that. A 30-minute chanting and dancing, Abdullah, it's King Abdullah, of course. This went on for 30 minutes. And finally he stood up and started doing a sort of a little tribal dance. It's very, very, very unusual. And I felt privileged to see it. I also had to have people help me interpret what was going on.
Right, right. So the book is called In Search of the Golden Ages. How many golden ages are we talking about?
We're talking about two previous ones. One that hardly anyone knows about, the Nabataean era. This was a spice trading culture that existed in Arabia 2,000 years ago. And it was sort of a linking point between India and points east and the Roman Empire, and it went through Arabia. Nobody knows about this. And this was a rich and very intriguing culture, and it created these beautiful architectural ruins, some of which we've seen in films like Raiders of the Lost Ark, those ruins at Petra and Jordan. That's all part of the Nabataean culture. Same quality ruins in Saudi, but because Saudi does not welcome casual tourism, nobody knows about them. They're just now being opened up. That's the first golden age. The second is, of course, the birth of Islamic civilization with the life of Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, and then the sweeping out of the Arab armies across all of the Middle East and North Africa into Spain and into Central Asia and North India. That's the second golden age. What we were trying to determine is if the current era of wealth and development in Saudi Arabia qualifies as a golden age, and I think we can say a cautious yes, but there are many things yet to be resolved in that story.
What is yet to be resolved? What do you mean?
Well, what we're talking about right now is one of the most rapid entries of a tribal nomadic culture into 21st century civilization on the globe. I mean, you can find other comparable cases, I suppose, in maybe Southeast Asia, maybe Malaysia, China, and then Saudi. Saudi really wakes up in 1938. That's when they discover oil there. Until then, it's a nomadic, harshly dry, hot, godforsaken place, not a center of world culture, really, for a long time, not since the fall of the Arab Caliphate. And they vault into, you know, they're a superpower now. They're a superpower on energy. They're the world's largest crude oil reserves. And they're also a superpower in religion because they have huge influence over 1.4 billion Muslims in the world. So they're a big deal. And they came into this reluctantly. But they, considering how far they've had to come, I mean, it's really a glass half full or half empty situation. We focus on the critique of, you know, women's rights and political repression and conservatism and so on. And when you look at it from their standpoint, they've come from living in tents and little mud houses to, you know, an energy superpower in 70 years.
What did you see in terms of women's rights or lack thereof?
We could spend some time on that. I interact primarily with upper-class, internationalized Saudi women. They have no constraints to speak of. I mean, they can't go out on the street and wear a bikini, but within the privacy of their own homes and when they travel, they can do whatever they want. Take, for example, Muna Abu Suleiman. She works for Prince Al Walid, who is a big broadcasting and investor investment group. She dresses like somebody from a Medici court. She's divorced. She leads an independent life. She can say whatever she wants.
Somebody from a Medici court?
Well, I say, yeah, that the way she dresses, you know, Saudi women do have to observe, you have to cover your hair, and you can't show much leg, arm, this sort of stuff.
Right.
And she doesn't cover her face, but she wears these beautiful designer things. I don't know who cooks them up for her, but they meet the dress code, and yet they are, you know, world-class fashion statements. So you have people like that. She's very outspoken. She doesn't have to be escorted by a man. She does whatever she wants. And then lots of other people that I interact with on down the socioeconomic ladder. But when you get into middle class and below, women are almost invisible. once they're married or once they're of a certain age, they have to be veiled. They can't officially talk to unrelated men without another family member present. They can fly an airplane. Listen to this. They can fly an airplane, but they cannot drive their car to the airport.
Right.
You know, this kind of contradiction. And so my interaction with the real, you know, silent majority of Saudi women is almost non-existent.
Right. So you don't, you can't comment on that because you were not able to do the research.
I mean, I'm aware of the things that are, while I was there last November, I believe it was, a case came out, a 78-year-old woman who had a stepson, went to meet the stepson and his friend. The stepson was about 22 and the friend was 23. The mutawin confronted them, accused her of being an adulteress for talking to an unrelated man. The religious police ruled that her stepson was not a relative, therefore she was engaged in adulterous conversation. She was sentenced to be lashed. Okay, she's 78. And this is just so, I mean, they have these contradictions. The upper class international Saudi women doing whatever, holding jobs, flying around the world, and so on.
But
and
a 78-year-old lady being lashed for talking to her stepson?
The king had to intervene.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And she wasn't lashed, but it had to go all the way to the king, as usual. You know?
Right, right, right. We're talking to Michael Hamilton Morgan. His book is called Arabia, In Search of the Golden Ages. Now, the book is called Arabia, not Saudi Arabia.
Right.
There's other countries, obviously, on the Arabian Peninsula.
That's right. As you go around the peninsula, starting up, I mean, I don't think Kuwait is technically part of the peninsula, but then you come down to Saudi, then you have Qatar, you have Bahrain, you have United Arab Emirates, you have... which are seven emirates within one country. Then you have Oman. Then you have Yemen, which used to be two countries. It's now an uneasy union of one. And then coming up the other side, I don't know whether you consider Jordan, piece of Jordan and the Arabian Peninsula or not, but it joined Saudi Arabia.
So, right.
Yeah.
Now, did these do any of these countries fall under the purview of your book?
They do, more in the historical sense. Because the spice trade came out of Yemen and Oman. In a way, you could say that Yemen is the cultural ideal or source of Arab sensibility. And that cuts many ways. But Yemen has always been disproportionately influential in the rest of Arabia. Yemen is wetter. It joins the Indian Ocean, a trading place, a lot of interaction with Africa and India and points east. And even today, the bin Laden family is from Yemen. So they're very influential in the rest of the Arab world.
We talked to you on this program about your book, Lost History, several years ago. And apparently, I mean, you know, the book had its place here in the United States, but apparently it was really a big hit in the Arab world, and you did a lot of traveling around this book.
That's right. We were very surprised. The publisher of that was National Geographic and Random House. We were focused on the U.S. market, but what we weren't prepared for was the reception in the Arab and broader Muslim world. The book's now gone into, I think, 10 languages, even in the Far East, Japanese, Korean, and... but the Arab reaction was the biggest surprise. I was just showered with, I mean, the president of Egypt, President Mubarak, gave me his presidential medal for arts and sciences, and I've been invited to meet any number of rulers and leaders and get to have direct interaction with them, which was a real surprise. It also shows, I think, the hunger over there to hear an American saying something positive about them and their contribution, because it's all negative right now. It's all bad.
Yeah. Well, I think, as we talked about when you were last here, one of the goals that you had was to start addressing some of the real misconceptions that Americans have about the Muslim world, about Arabic-speaking people, and so on. What are some of those misconceptions?
Well, the misconceptions that we have on this side of the world is that this culture and this faith are universally hostile, violent, aggressive, anti-intellectual, anti-women, anti-liberal, anti-democracy, anti-everything that's part of our world, that it's something in total opposition to who we are.
And as you write in this book, you have a situation that you noticed in Saudi Arabia, which was a lot of liberal people on the coast and then more conservatives right. in the heartland.
It's not like the U.S.
familiar.
Because it's just not a uniform culture. Saudi Arabia has only been a unified country since 1922. And these different regions have their own characters. The West on the Red Sea is really connected to Egypt and to the Mediterranean and to Africa. And then the East is really hooked up with Iran because it's only 70 miles across the water to Iran. So there's a lot of Persian influence over there. So those two sides they're just more open. They always were. Women are freer. They're not covered up like they are. But now Riyadh in the central part, that's the Bedouin, that's the heartland, that's where the Saudi family, the family of the Al-Sauds and the Wahhabi religious group, that's where they come from.
And so how do all of these groups interact with each other? I mean, is there anything that you saw that resembles kind of political dialogue?
Well, what it is a very carefully crafted series of trade-offs and coalitions, kind of a tribal deals in a way. The Saudi royal family is really good at patching things together with different groups, both within the country and internationally. They've learned how to do that. They make deals. They make trades. You get this, I get that. And so with these different concessions, always done quietly behind closed doors, everybody gets a piece of the pie, some sort of a satisfaction, and so it holds together that way.
One of the things that I think is important to talk about also is what was the point of view on the United States of the people that you met while you were doing research for this book?
It was almost moving to meet so many people in this place that we consider to be so alien and in some ways hostile to us, to find so many people who studied here, who have friends here, who've traveled here or whatever, who have a connection, and they've lost it because of the last 8 years. I mean, I describe an event where the king has a big celebration. I'm the only American there. I'm totally alone, and I don't know what I'm doing. And all of a sudden, people come up, and they want to have their picture taken with me. They don't know who I am.
Right.
They just know I'm an American. And they start asking me, do you know Joe Blow in Milwaukee and all that? And I say, no, I don't. And they say, oh, I've lost touch. And it was sad because I realized, I mean, we helped build that country. Americans don't realize that. We have more influence in that country than any other Middle Eastern place than Israel, I would say. It's just all over the way the cities were laid out, how the government was set up, the educational system and so on was American. The Saudis came to President Roosevelt and they said, teach us how to be modern.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the reasons.
For better or worse.
I mean,
with all the, you know, you show these sort of skyscraper cell phone culture and presumably all the ills, physical and spiritual, that arise from that.
Well, that's one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda has focused on the U.S.-Saudi relationship to try and break it up, because they realized how strong it was, despite this huge cultural and religious difference. And I was amazed to see how much of it still survives. In terms of hostility, I know a young advertising executive, and I quote him in the book, I don't name him, but he confessed that on 9/11, he felt like some justice was done, because he empathized with the Palestinians just like most Arabs. They see it from that frame. And he said, I felt like America needed to feel some pain like we feel. Now, when I've expressed it to some of my American friends in New York, I thought I was going to have my head blown off. But
there are Americans who feel that way, too, who understand that point of view.
There are some. It's hard right now with this mosque argument in New York. But
it's so ridiculous. I can't even, don't even go there.
But he said, that's the way I felt then. He said, over the last 8-9 years, I've realized that this kind of, you know, violent tit for tat, it goes nowhere. It just kills people. It does not resolve anything. And so he is, he's hoping that, you know, he's very much pro-Obama and so on. He's hoping that these nonviolent methods of dealing with this cultural difference can succeed, because he doesn't want to let his children grow up in a horrible mess.
We're talking to Michael Hamilton Morgan. The book is called Arabia in Search of the Golden Ages, and we started out talking about the IMAX movie that was being made, right, that you were consulting on, and many of whose images appear in this book. Where is this movie being shown in the United States? Unfortunately, it's not at the IMAX theater in Albuquerque, which is too bad.
Yeah. It is in Denver, as far as I know right now, and it's in at least 20 other locales, primarily big cities, New York, Atlanta, and so on.
And the hope of this movie is to basically show Americans that, hey, we're all people.
Yeah, it's just really, it's not trying to cover up the dark side of Saudi Arabia, because there is one, just like there's a dark side to almost everywhere. But what it's trying to do is show that these are human beings, and they're not outside the pale of human experience, and they developed along a very different line, and just to open, because, you know, it's been very closed. Unless you're a Muslim, you're not, or unless you work for an oil company, you're not going to go there. And so our understanding of that place is created by headlines and the latest terrible thing or terrorist issue or something, and that defines it for us. Well, you know, I've been there many times. I walk around. I've never seen anybody being beheaded or lashed. I've never seen it. All the worst thing I can say about it is that it's incredibly hot, and it can be very boring at times, because the streetscape doesn't have the spice of, say, you know, a Western city, because there's just a lot of things that can't go on. It's all men walking around. You don't see very many. You don't see any Saudi women, really, except zooming past in a chauffeur-driven car or something. It's just sometimes stultifying, but it doesn't feel like an evil place or whatever.
Well, Michael Hamilton Morgan, you will be speaking this coming Saturday, the 28th of August, at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books, and people will be able to hear you and get a hold of a copy of this book.
Good. I look forward to having people there.
Good. Well, it's been great to have you on the air again, and thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.